The title for this afternoon's session is rather provocative. It's How Not to Think About God. Stanford Kazir, president of Utah State University, will be presenting the paper. And after President Kazir's remarks, we'll hear a response from Father Frank Mannion, who's in doctoral studies at Catholic University of America. So as not to intrude more into the time, I think we'll let the participants field their own questions if there is time after the presentation, and we welcome your response and questions thereafter.
There probably should be a word of explanation of why I'm doing this, presenting this paper. Some in the audience might say, why shouldn't the president be attending to the faculty salaries or the legislature or the governor or capital facilities? Those are the kinds of things that presidents of universities generally attend to. And that's been the steady diet I've had now for more than a dozen years. So when I had occasion to read a book recently, it brought back fond memories of an associate. That implies I only read books occasionally. But it brought back fond associations of seminars and symposia like this when I was a student of philosophy a few years ago and a professor of cultural history. That's the occasion, really, and because my bachelor's degree was in philosophy, master's in intellectual history, medieval civilization, modern intellectual Europe at Wisconsin. This is really a review essay. The admonition, "Know God," is central to the Judeo-Christian tradition. Books which ask questions about God's existence, or which otherwise cause us to think about him, can presume to be of interest to those of us who are the progeny of that tradition. About a year ago, I read Mortimer J. Adler's How to Think About God, A Guide for the 20th Century Pagan. I was intrigued by the title, as I assume all Sunstone readers would be, and have entertained a somewhat pathological interest in Adler for almost three decades. That interest has been whetted by his awesome erudition, his prodigious scholarship, and his incredible methodological rigidity. His breadth of knowledge is demonstrated by his thorough familiarity with the great and good writers of the Western world, writers suggested to the reader of Adler's How to Read a Book, The Art of Getting a Liberal Education, 1940, and by the two-volume Syntopicon he wrote to introduce the great books of the Western world. The Syntopicon consists essentially of a series of articles elucidating and cross-referencing the 102 basic ideas embedded in the 50-plus great books and represents an impressive comprehensive reference tool. His scholarship is confirmed in the publication of more than 30 books and 100 articles over a period of 50 years. These publications range from discourses on language, philosophy, psychology, law, music, art, and politics to the reform of education. The reader might rightfully ask, at this point, can a person of this erudition and scholarship be lacking in methodological sophistication? In my opinion, the answer is most assuredly. I first became aware of his methodological naivete when I read his contribution to Science, Philosophy, and Religion, a symposium in 1941. In his paper, Professor Adler defended President Robert Hutchins of the University of Chicago in his efforts to reform American education. In that defense, he stated that Professor Hutchins proposed that science, quote, that science, philosophy, and theology are distinct bodies of knowledge, radically different as to methods of knowing, as well as with respect to objects known. Adler went further. He said that, quote, theoretic philosophy delves more deeply into the nature of things than all the empirical sciences. That as theoretic knowledge, philosophy is superior to the sciences by reason of the questions it can answer. End of quote. That statement was patent nonsense when Adler wrote it in 1940. It was when I read it in 1950 and remains so today. The objects of philosophical and theological focus may be sublime indeed, but to assert that the epistemology of philosophy and theology is superior to science is just short of absurd. No wonder Lord Bertrand Russell once said that he, quote, greatly admired Dr. Adler's rugged simplicity. I am less generous than Lord Russell. Dr. Adler's simplicity, albeit rugged, is astonishing. Aristotle is Adler's intellectual father and Thomas Aquinas his godfather. If we start from the premise that truth can somehow be inferred from Aristotelian syllogisms, then we are well on the way to understanding the simplicity of Adler's mental processes. Dr. Adler was a recent guest on William Buckley's television talk show. They were addressing Adler's latest book, Six Great Ideas: Truth, Beauty, Goodness, Liberty, Equality, Justice, published in 1981. Mr. Buckley asked Dr. Adler to give the audience an example of an absolute or categorical... Things have not changed in 30 years here. Mr. Buckley asked Dr. Adler to give the audience an example of an absolute categorical truth. Without hesitation, Adler offered a classic Aristotelian syllogism to the effect that if someone suggested that all swans are white, and then if one black swan were discovered, the first proposition would have been proven false. As any student of elementary logic knows, this is only the case in formal logic and has nothing whatever to do with truth in the real world. A black swan or two among a sea of white swans only confirms the generalization that swans are white. The character of truth which Adler offered to Buckley in the television audience illustrates how Adler could think that philosophy and theology are superior to science. I am sure that Dr. Adler understands the distinction between deductive and inductive inference, or conclusion drawn from formal logic and scientific generalizations. But he appears to suppress this understanding. In much of his writing, but especially in this book, he seems to blend the language or dialectic of philosophy with its substance. The effect of this error is that he assumes a relationship between the dialectic of philosophy and the world of reality, a relationship he fails to establish. One might expect that Adler would have been shorn of his Thomistic, non-Catholic bias with the maturation of philosophy and especially science over the past 40 years. But How to Think About God was written by a committed philosophical disciple of Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, and Adler engages in a spectacular time skip in offering Aristotle and Aquinas to the 20th century thinker. Adler first read Aristotle's Metaphysics as an undergraduate at Columbia University in the early 1920s and was, quote, fascinated with the argument for God's existence in Book 12, end of quote. The year after he had graduated from Columbia and had become a member of its faculty, he discovered the Summa Theologicae of St. Thomas. During the next 20 years, Adler was, persuaded that Aquinas, by reason alone, and without any insight derived from religious beliefs or dogma, had succeeded in proving God's existence. This confession might be expected of a disciplined Dominican monk in the 13th century, but is amazing for a 20th century philosopher. While Adler claims that his book's closest affinity is with Aristotle's philosophical thinking about God, his model really is Aquinas. Adler intends to correct the errors of inference which he discovered in rereading Aquinas in 1943 after 20 years of acceptance of Aquinas' cosmological argument for God's existence. Adler begins his argument with the defense that, quote, failure to prove God's existence concerns only the reasonableness of belief in God, end of quote. The simple facts of the matter are that belief in God may be reasonable but falls short of logical proof. However, belief in God is not exhausted by being either rational or irrational. It may be non-rational. But the existence of God is not, in the final analysis, a function of logical or rational demonstration. Few philosophers beyond David Hume have given either the ontological or the cosmological argument for God's existence, taking it very seriously. The existence of God turns on empirical evidence, not purely rational processes. In this regard, philosophy and theology have been dry wells for years, certainly before Adler claimed for them special methodological superiority over science. If God's existence is ever proven by the mind of man, it will not be by the avenue of philosophical theology. It seems that Adler has not thrown off a youthful fascination for the, quote, dialectics of objections advanced and rebutted by Aquinas, which, end of quote, by which Adler's own admission, quote, overshadowed his interest in the truth or falsity of what he was reading, end of quote. After 20 years of asserting that Aquinas had proven God's existence by reason alone, Adler realized that he had, quote, little or no understanding of the philosophical problems involved in any attempt by reason alone to prove God's existence, end of quote. He claims that he now has that understanding. In 1943, he published an article, The Demonstration of God's Existence, in The Thomist. In that article, Adler concluded three things. One, Aristotle had not proven God's existence. Two, Aquinas had not proven God's existence, in part because he relied too heavily on Aristotle. And three, while God's existence may someday be proven, that task has not yet been accomplished. For the next 30 years, Adler held the view that he had advanced in 1943, that God's existence had not been proven by reason. Only in the 1970s did Adler regain the confidence he had in the 20s and 30s, that God's existence could be proven by reason alone, and that while Aquinas had not been able to do so, he, Adler, could. To recapitulate, at approximately 20 years of age, Adler discovered Aquinas, and for that matter, Aristotle. And for the next 20 years, believed that Aquinas had demonstrated God's existence by reason alone. Then at the age of 40, Adler discovered flaws in Aquinas' reasoning, which led Adler to conclude that the Summa did not contain the rational proof he had held to for half of his life. For the next 30 years, Adler made efforts to perfect that demonstration, only to reaffirm he could not do it. Then at approximately 70 years of age, 70, Adler made a breakthrough and represents his book as the rational demonstration lacking in the Summa. His new confidence is born in part from a careful rereading of the major works of the French Catholic philosopher Étienne Gilson, and also Jacques Maritain, who he does not reference so directly. More fundamentally, his new confidence stems from the recognition that argument of contemporary analytical and linguistic philosophy against the reasonable basis for God's existence misfire completely on metaphysical grounds. By definition, metaphysics represents speculation on the nature of reality which soars above or beyond rational or scientific demonstration. To say that someone's metaphysical speculation has misfired is a value judgment. When one enters the world of metaphysics, he or she is floating beyond the known laws of science. It can be a heady experience indeed, and a productive one, but generally the experience is more closely associated with science fiction than the true world of reality. At best, metaphysical speculations are interesting. The true value of such forays has to be a function of scientific endeavor. Physics, mathematics, chemistry, Mathematics for me is in the same realm as formal logic. It doesn't belong to the sciences, so I apologize for that. The truth value of such forays has to be a function of scientific endeavor. Physics, chemistry, microbiology, not metaphysics. In the section of his book, Errors to be Avoided, Adler makes a primitive effort to confront modern cosmology in the form of the Big Bang Theory, or steady-state theory relative to the origin of the universe. In the course of his confrontation, he interdigitates philosophy, reminding us that Aristotle and Averroes, the Muslim philosopher of the Middle Ages, believed the universe was everlasting. Aquinas, on the other hand, could not accept the idea of a universe not having a beginning. It did damage to his Christian belief that God created the universe out of nothing, a process that Adler refers to as ex nihilo. But Aquinas and later Kant held that philosophical reasoning could not prove one way or the other the eternality of the universe. Adler, on the other hand, is anxious to avoid steadfastly and stringently, quote, steadfastly and stringently, the error of begging the question by assuming what is to be proved. What this means is that Adler will accept the assumption of Aristotle and Averroes that the universe is eternal. In this way, he can avoid the assumption of the existence of God, the Creator. A parenthetical observation, Mormons may be the only Christians whose theology would not be offended by Adler proceeding on this cautious assumption. Adler does not allow for diverse connotations to the word create. He confines his connotation of creation to a very narrow theological tradition. In that tradition, to create means to bring into existence that which has not existed before. In short, to generate out of nothing. By logical extension, if Adler starts with the assumption of an eternal universe, then he can also assume endless causation, and therefore suspend inquiry into the existence of the first cause, at least temporarily. In setting the stage of his proof, Adler insists that we must eschew, quote, the connotations attached to the word God by the religious doctrines of the West. And then he suggests that God designates a unique object, but one which does not belong to any class of objects. What this implies is that classification requires more than one object in the class. And since God, by definition, is a unique object, he fails of classification. Possibly so. But again, by arbitrary definition, it is conceivable that there could be a class of one, the unique object God. Also, God is not necessarily excluded from general classification, namely, other gods. The God whose existence Adler attempts to demonstrate is designated as being totally beyond the reach of direct acquaintance. Just because one cannot, in rational demonstration, appeal to the testimony of those who claim to have had direct acquaintance with God, does not rule out the possibility of direct acquaintance with God. Adler is even arbitrary in the use of definition. He states that since God cannot be known by direct acquaintance and cannot be classified, he cannot be defined. Only identified by, quote, a definite description. This is just too precious. By extension, Adler insists that God has no connotative significance. This is solipsistic reasoning, logic carried to an absurd extreme. Even if we accept Adler's view that God stands in a class of one, meaning can only attach to that class of denotative and connotative significance associated with the word designating the object. Adler denies that the reader may properly ask for the definition, conception, and meaning of God. He further insists that we cannot think of God as a physical object. To all of this, it can be said, there is no logical reason for not so asking or so thinking. God, even of theological inquiry, is not precluded from connotation nor physical existence. Since Adler rules out the possibility that God is physical, material, or corporeal, we are somehow obligated to use the word theoretical construct rather than an empirical concept in referring to God. Adler may not realize that in science, generally speaking, theories are never true or false, just useful. And generally, the more useful theoretical constructs are themselves derived from empirical constructs or concepts. What Adler attempts to do is give theological inquiry a legitimacy through an analogy with science by the use of theoretical constructs. Theories relating to elementary particles and black holes were constructed in response to phenomena observed or detected by various means available to science. And if this theoretical inquiry is to have the legitimacy that Adler claims by analogy, there has to be an equivalent phenomenological basis which drives theorizing in science. Theoretical constructs which evolve totally independent of perception or empirical concepts are generally of limited use. Immanuel Kant hammered this home in the 18th century. Until recently, Adler had accepted Anselm's 11th century ontological argument for God's argument as being an adequate basis. The ontological is that God is that than which can perceive nothing greater to exist. Again, fundamentally an argument by definition. As being an adequate basis for articulating a definitive description of God. But by engaging in a bit of semantic subtlety, Adler claims that we cannot have a conception of God, only a notion. To be such, God must, quote, be thought of as either part of the physical cosmos, two, identical with the cosmos as a whole, or three, the cosmos was he thought of part of God, end of quote. Adler assumes that this enumeration exhausts the possibilities. God could also be part of the physical cosmos, but substantially apart from it or above it. Biochemically, neurons, synapses, and enzymes which support the functions of the brain may not appear to be quantitatively different from those which support other anatomical functions. However, the brain is the basis for mental processes without which other anatomical functions would not be. An analogical relationship could be suggested between the concept of God, the brain, and the cosmos. Finally, by additional faulty logic, Adler states that God is a proper theoretical construct analogous to elementary particles and black holes, even though there is no primary. I'm repeating myself here, I think, but for emphasis. That's a good pedagogical technique I was told in the third grade. Finally, by additional faulty logic, Adler states that God is a proper theoretical construct analogous to elementary particles and black holes, even though there is no primary phenomena for which the concept is indispensable. This leads Adler to the amazing conclusion that, quote, the proposition God exists cannot be falsified by discovery of any facts not already known to us. End of quote. Only by definition can this be the case and appears to be most arbitrary. In the fourth section of his book, Adler shares with the reader why he thinks the best traditional argument for the existence of God fails. He enunciates five premises on which the traditional argument has generally been based. But he rejects the third premise, which is, a contingent being is one that needs a cause of its continuing existence at every moment of its endurance in existence. End of quote. His reasoning for rejecting this premise is predicated on the glib generalization that, quote, something akin to the principle of inertia applies in the realm of existence, end of quote. Inertia is a very useful principle to explain bodies at rest and in motion. But extending inertia from the, quote, physics of motion to the metaphysics of being is more than a quantum leap. Adler does ascend to the anticlimactic for his final, truly cosmological argument for the existence of God. His argument goes essentially as follows. He denies exhalation, the bringing into existence from nothing, and annihilation, the passing out of existence into nothingness, to individual, contingent existence. Individual elements in the cosmos exist by what he terms superficial contingency, which means that when they cease to be, they emerge in another form, such through the conversion of energy to matter, and vice versa. For as the cosmos exists by radical contingency, when the cosmos ceases to exist, there is nothing, neither form nor matter. Therefore, Adler argues that the truly cosmological argument must be applied to the cosmos as a whole. Very simply then, quote, the cosmos radically contingent in existence would not exist at all were its existence not caused, end of quote. And God exists to act as the, quote, creative cause of the existence of the cosmos in the first place and the, quote, preservative cause of the continuing existence of the cosmos. A simple response to this line of reasoning is that if contingent existence is superficial in character and does not require preservative cause other than inertia, why cannot the physics of motion be applied to the metaphysics of being as far as the cosmos itself is concerned? This is not a persuasive line of reasoning, but it would seem to be a logical extension of Adler's. Restated, if inertia provides for the continuing existence of individual elements within the cosmos, why cannot inertia provide for the continuing existence of the cosmos as a whole? If one accepts the first premise, it is just as easy to accept the second. Finally, Adler leaves unanswered several propositions. For example, he states that we know the cosmos exists, but we don't know whether its existence is caused or uncaused. He argues for the former. Also, he says, we do not know whether a supreme being exists. But if God does exist, we do not have to ask whether God's existence is caused or uncaused, since it is presumed that God's existence is uncaused. Again, this is argument by definition. He also unabashedly proclaims that a created cosmos is more likely than an uncreated cosmos. There is no persuasive logic or evidence to support such a proposition. A month ago, I was attending that which I generally do in relation to higher education. I don't leave the state too often, but I was persuaded this conference was worthwhile. It was one on excellence in higher education at Colorado Springs by the American Council on Education. It just so happens that Professor Adler was there as a participant in the conference, and he had not had lunch, so I invited him to lunch. And we sat and discussed his book for an hour. It was a delightful experience. And this is really not fair to Professor Adler, because he didn't have a chance to rebut it. And if anything's ever published sometime, and don't know that it would be, this portion would be left out, I think, of a final document without his opportunity to say something. I had the opportunity to discuss these and other propositions in his book with Professor Adler earlier this month at a higher education conference at Colorado Springs. I asked him how he could be sure that a person's arguments misfire completely on metaphysical grounds. He did not answer me directly, but instead referred to me to A.T.N. Gilson's Being and Other and Some Philosophers, where he proclaims that Gilson does the devastation. In fairness to both Adler and Gilson, I have read parts of Gilson, but not that particular book. I'm sure it's an important book. He claims that Gilson provides an adequate demonstration in that book. I also asked him why a created cosmos was more likely than an uncreated cosmos, and his answer to me sounded more like he was, in fact, begging the question, something he wanted to avoid throughout the course of his demonstration. I further suggested that Aristotle had identified some 40 prime movers and that God could conceivably enjoy a class with other gods. Such a notion, he insisted, would detract from the concept of the supreme being, and that if there were other gods, they could only be referred to with the small case g. I also objected to his extending inertia from the physics of motion to the metaphysics of being, to which he merely replied that a graduate student had suggested the appropriateness of the application of the principle of inertia to superficial contingency. After an hour's conversation with Professor Adler, I drew two conclusions. He's a very gracious individual, but as rigid in his methodology as I had presumed. In his last chapter, Adler attempts to bridge the chasm between the God of philosophy and the God of religion. In this attempt at bridge construction, Adler is particularly anxious to caution the reader against one of the most grievous of all theological mistakes, that of an anthropomorphic notion of God, a notion that is both unphilosophical, irreligious, and superstitious. Adler's rejection of anthropomorphism is a logical extension of his earlier rejection of the possibility of God being physical, material, or corporeal. But the warning that the reader may be wandering into forbidden waters of the unphilosophical and irreligious, not to mention the superstitious, by adopting anthropomorphism is not sufficient evidence or reasonable grounds for rejecting the notion. None of the attributes one ordinarily ascribes to God of philosophy or the God of theology necessarily precludes an anthropomorphic notion of God. The classic refutation of anthropomorphism is supposed to have been offered by Xenophanes when he suggested that if asses and oxen believed in gods, they would portray them in their own images. That hypothetical if could be applied to the entire world of the animate and even the inanimate, if one has the imagination to entertain the suggestion. But the application by Xenophanes of the hypothetical is no refutation of a possible anthropomorphic God, or a God who is physical, material, or corporeal. Evidence and logic do not require the preclusion. Toward the end of his book, Adler reaffirms the proposition he took in 1940, quote, that rational philosophical inquiry is a persistent effort to explain what needs to be explained and cannot be explained by scientific investigation. What Adler does not seem to realize that if scientific investigation, cannot explain that which demands explanation, neither can rational philosophical inquiry, at least not since the scientific revolution. But he does not stop short of the categorical. Quote, our conclusion that God exists cannot be affirmed with certitude, but only beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay? End of quote. The greatest distance between Adler and myself is based on our differing perceptions as to what philosophy can do. Adler advances the view that philosophical inquiry is a methodology that leads one to a category of truth unavailable to other disciplines and methods. My position is closer to that of Wittgenstein. Quote, "The object of philosophy is the logical clarification of thought," end of quote. In my judgment, philosophy can only deal with possibilities, not truth per se. It does not have a special methodological capacity to ascertain truth, that is, truth unavailable to other methodologies. In the final analysis, one could rightfully ask, if we can concede or could concede all of Adler's arguments, what have we got? The answer is not very much. Adler himself recognizes that the God whose existence he thinks he has demonstrated, quote, beyond a reasonable doubt, is like Aristotle's God, unavailable for worship, prayer, guidance, or any other religious purpose associated with the God of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Adler's God does not love, does not have mercy or justice. His is an anemic existence, albeit omniscient and omnipotent. He exists purely as the source of the existence of the cosmos. Pascal claimed, quite rightly in my judgment, that reason cannot do what Adler claims for it. And if other readers agree with Pascal, Adler realizes they will be, quote, justified in putting his book down with a deep sense of dissatisfaction, period, end of quote. My dissatisfaction is not deep, for I had no expectation that Adler could deliver on his claim. My dissatisfaction associates with an unimaginative effort. Following the metaphor of his mentor, Aristotle, Adler hoped his argument would be rich in form and matter. What he delivered is a clear combination of almost formless matter and matterless form, signifying nothing. At best, his effort is warmed over hash, better articulated and reasoned by both Aristotle and Aquinas. When they wrote it, it had a vitality and meaning which is lost in the 20th century mind, because while we may lack their genius, we do have the perspective and sophistication which several centuries of intellectual development have wrought. If I have found Adler unexciting and unpersuasive, so may those of you who hear or read my attempt at refutation. And it would seem to me this would be an appropriate place to offer a caveat to protect both Adler and myself from further abuse. It is drawn from Walter Kaufmann's Critique of Philosophy and Religion, 1961. Quote, "What is definitive, if anything, is an occasional refutation. But even those who offer conclusive refutations usually get involved in errors of their own. And nowhere are such errors more frequent than in passages in which philosophers speak of God. Even the greatest thinkers, not to speak of minor men like your speaker today, begin to stumble and fumble when they try to deal with God." End of quote. In striking contrast to Adler's fruitless effort to help the 20th century Western think about God is a most fruitful vineyard planted in Germany in 1978 and translated last year. I am referring to Hans Kuhn's truly challenging book, Does God Exist? An Answer for Today, 1980. This book is a companion to his widely respected On Being a Christian, 1976. The form and matter of the book are both compelling. Like Kant and Pascal, Kuhn rejects the philosophical possibility of being able to prove God's existence by reason. Kuhn's approach, therefore, is not philosophical, but rather historical. Not of ideas per se, but of, quote, concrete human beings made up of flesh and blood, with their doubting, struggling, and suffering, their belief and unbelief, with all the questions that still stir us today, end of quote. Kuhn's answer to his own question is, yes, God exists. But his answer is not a declaration beyond reasonable doubt. It is more a leap of faith, not unlike that of Pascal, an expression of faith drawn from the wellspring of his own philosophical confrontation with the nature of reality and variations on that confrontation by some of the finest thinkers over the past four centuries. There is a freshness and a depth to Kuhn's historical analysis, whereas in Adler, a narrow and very traditional line of reasoning dulls the senses. The reasonableness of trust in ultimate reality is the focus of Kuhn's analysis, and is a much more vital issue than the quest for the source of the existence of the cosmos. Kuhn plumbs the breadth and depths of human existence. Adler approaches his task as if mankind had been annihilated. Certainly, man alive, breathing, doubting, fearing, plays no part in Adler's equation. Trust is a human need and represents no proposition or premise in either the ontological or cosmological argument for God's existence. Trust is also more psychological and religious in nature than philosophical. Ultimately, the question of God's existence is a matter of faith and trust, born of experience and reason. But the greatest of these is faith and trust. Thank you.
Had Dr. Crozier set out to affirm the validity for our time of Adler's natural theology, I, like most members of the contemporary Roman Catholic theological community, would have no hesitation disagreeing with him. Contemporary Roman Catholic theology in general no longer looks to Aristotle as its grandfather, nor to Aquinas as its father. And thus my first happy task is to add agreement to the basic thrust of Dr. Crozier's critique. It is indeed quite difficult to support an argument that the epistemology of theology or philosophy is superior to that of the empirical sciences. It is quite uncompelling to present arguments for God's existence based on reason alone. And I heartily agree with Dr. Crozier that the God demonstrated by rational argument is not up to very much. He is not a God who inspires worship or prayer. He is not a God of love or mercy or justice. Pascal, at least in one sense, is quite right. The God of the philosophers is not the God of Moses, Isaac, and Jacob. But it would be rather boring simply to affirm what Dr. Crozier has said. So I do indeed find myself able to raise some questions in response to his critique. While I am not at all compelled by rational arguments for God's existence, and I doubt that anyone ever really was, I am not, however, willing to see the enterprise in which Thomas Aquinas and even Adler were engaged as quite useless. And this is perhaps because I see the relationship between revelation and philosophical inquiry in a somewhat different way than Dr. Crozier does. Dr. Crozier quotes Wittgenstein, "The object of philosophy is the logical clarification of thought." I would not want to take blanket exception to that, and I do see how that would preclude much appreciation for what natural theologians seek to do. I would find myself closer to Paul Ricoeur, seeing philosophy as a process by which symbol gives rise to thought. To recast Pascal, the God of the philosophers is indeed the God of revelation, the God revealed in symbol, but translated into the categories of scientific thought, although losing much in the translation. It is the God of faith who gives rise to the God of philosophy, not vice versa. As I see it, philosophy does not fail because it cannot prove God's existence. Rather, philosophy is inadequate to the richness of faith experience. What Thomas Aquinas sought to do, in my opinion, is to push philosophical language to its limits. And whether he thought he was basing his operations on faith or not, he really couldn't but base his operations on faith. It takes little familiarity with contemporary philosophy and theology to realize that there are a whole variety of hermeneutical issues involved in understanding Thomas Aquinas or in understanding any kind of language exercise or any kind of thought. There is a a great deal of difference between what we think we are doing and what we are really doing. There is a great deal of difference between what we think we are saying and what we are really saying, and indeed a great difference between what we think we are reading and what we are really reading. If Adler makes a fundamental mistake, it is precisely in an unsophisticated attempt to, as Dr. Kusir says, make a spectacular time skip in offering Aristotle and Aquinas to the 20th century thinker. That is fatal on his part. For what Thomas Aquinas was doing in the 13th century is quite different from what he appears to be doing to a 20th century rationalist. Theological or philosophical fundamentalism and literal-mindedness are no less dangerous than biblical fundamentalism. Just because Aquinas appears to us to have set himself the task of rationally proving God's existence does not in fact mean that that is what he was doing. I am not about to construct a positive hermeneutic for approaching Aquinas, but it is necessary to point out that there is more to Aquinas' natural theology than meets the eye. The attempt to do natural theology in the 20th century is quite a different matter from attempting the same enterprise in a 13th century world of faith. Thus, we need to think twice about what Thomas Aquinas really was doing. To return to my main point, therefore, I do see a value even in what Adler seeks to do, although not in the way he does it, because I do believe that the primordial revelation of God in the symbols of a religious tradition may and must indeed give rise to and be pushed forward into philosophical reflection if they are not to remain purely subjective and private. Revelation must enter into all the forms and shapes of philosophical discourse, even into the games of the games philosophy plays. If one of the games is proof, then that's fine. If theology fails, then that's fine too. But somehow the enterprise must go on and be pushed at all times to the limits. The affirmation of God's existence is amenable to rational discussion and justification. That's what theology is all about. I do believe that the experience of divine presence in the world implies that there are rational grounds for this belief, which are in principle accessible to philosophical reflection. A belief in God or a testimony to his presence, cut loose from any claim to objective rational foundation and grounded in sheer subjectivity, must inevitably appear mere fantasy. Theology is always the enterprise of faith seeking understanding. Faith that does not seek understanding remains closed, sectarian, and irrelevant. Theology, then, is never the enterprise of understanding seeking faith. I do not think that Thomas Aquinas could be accused of conducting the latter enterprise, though this is apparently what Adler thought Thomas was doing, and this is what Adler certainly appears to be doing himself. And this is where Adler, of course, is most vulnerable. So philosophy does not build a bridge over the chasm between reason and faith, with the person standing on the side of reason. Rather, philosophy builds a bridge between the world of faith, which is the primary world, and the public world of human experience and understanding. Philosophical theology is faith moving language and thought to its limits. Briefly, then, I agree with Dr. Kusir that Adler does not succeed very well in his enterprise. He goes about it badly. Philosophy does not lead up to the threshold of faith. Where I would perhaps disagree with Dr. Kusir is in what I perceive to be an extreme dislike, which he shares with many contemporary theologians, for natural theology. But such a suspicion is always extreme when the bad methodology of some practitioners leads to the rejection of a whole intellectual enterprise that has clearly borne some fruit in Christian history and thought.
I would just like to respond to that, because it was so gracious that I really can find no fault with it. In fact, there's nothing in what Father Mannion said assailable, I do not think. I accept that slight rebuke because I think it was warranted. The association of Adler with Aquinas is that we have an intellectual pygmy or parasite riding on the back of a genius. And therefore I do think it does mask my appreciation for Thomas Aquinas, which is considerable. I used to teach cultural history, as I indicated, and many students had come out of high schools with some perception that the Middle Ages was somehow a dead period, a dark period, and so on. And I used to throw out the challenge. I said, you find for me just one man, just one, in the Renaissance, any period of the Renaissance, and I don't care who you want, John Addington Symond, Jacob Burckhardt's Renaissance, any Renaissance beginning with Italy going to Northern England, from the 14th century to the 17th century, that can match Thomas Aquinas, and I will accept the idea that the Middle Ages was dead. But you don't have anyone that can match him in intellectual fervor or in exclamation of faith. So I accept that most graciously. Thank you.
I think we're going to have to close without any questions. If you want to talk to the participants afterward, you're welcome to. Thank you. And thank you.